This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This is a nice first step which has been teed up by the UN, Germany, the US, as well as different Libyan actors who, given the stalemate in the military situation, would like to work on these important longer-term questions. However, just because people are talking about...
That's Jason Pack of the Middle East Institute and founder of Libya's Analysis on reports of progress in talks between Libya's two governments. Details coming up. Also, the International Committee of the Red Cross is struggling to provide aid to thousands of people fleeing conflict in northern Mozambique. And voting starts in Ethiopia's Tigray region today in defiance of the federal government. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. A dialogue between Libya's rival governments has yielded important understandings that include setting clear rules to eliminate corruption, cut the waste of public money, and end institutional division. A spokesperson on behalf of the Libyan High Council of State and the Parliament of Tobruk said both parties hope to achieve good and tangible results to end Libya's crisis. The U.S. welcomed the talks that started on Monday in Morocco. The talks will conclude tomorrow with the delegations focusing on amending a political agreement signed in Sekharat, Morocco in 2015. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed the initial positive results of the talks with Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute and the founder of Libya Analysis.
This is music to my ears. It's nice to hear the different sides talking about the correct issues. And those issues are corruption, how oil revenues are distributed, and the issues with the semi-sovereign institutions and who has the right to control wealth. That said, it's really important that we don't get ahead of ourselves. This is a nice first step, which has been teed up by the UN, Germany, the US, as well as different Libyan actors who, given the stalemate in the military situation, would like to work on these important longer-term questions. However, just because people are talking about the right things doesn't mean they have the incentives to do them. And a lot of the people with power were not actually in the room and are not at these discussions. So that's likely going to be the same problem that we saw with the 2015 Sekharat discussions, which also took place in Morocco. In other words, military people, militias and others were not invited. And hence politicians talked and they said, you know, we're going to make a peace deal, but they didn't have the power to deliver.
The talks will continue for a fourth day, and the two Libyan dialogue delegations will focus on an understanding regarding the implementation of Article 15 of Sekharat Agreement, which relates to the referendum on the Constitution. Help us understand how important is such understanding to the future of a political solution in Libya.
It's the most important thing. Article 15 is really what Sekharat brought to the Libyan institutional scene. And the Sekharat agreement calls sovereign institutions. This means the central bank, the audit bureau, the Supreme Court, and many other bodies. And all of the heads of those institutions have overstayed their mandates. So we need to figure out a way how to unify these institutions that at least the majority of Libyans will accept, and then to internationalize the reform process of those institutions. And that's what I call the creation of the International Financial Commission. And I've heard a lot talked about before, so I'm not getting optimistic, but at least these are the right questions which are being addressed.
Many observers expect a breakthrough following the Libyan dialogue in Morocco as the first step to reaching a new political agreement, which some call Sekharat 2. But others are concerned that the commander of the Libyan National Army, Khalifa Haftar, could spoil all kinds of agreements, especially that he was excluded from this dialogue. What's your take on that?
It's not just Haftar as an Eastern military commander or his chief of staff who've been excluded, but all of the powerful Western militias are not present either. This is a follow-up to the Sclerat Treaty with the heads and delegations of the institutions that Sclerat either created or vested power in meeting. And this is the political class. The political class in Libya doesn't have backing on the ground, and they certainly don't control the arms. So what they have in their gift is the ability to replace the heads of the semi-sovereign institutions. And if they don't do that in a very delicate way, consulting with these powers on the ground, of course, the powers on the ground will try to spoil if their interests are harmed.
UN Secretary General welcomed the Libyan dialogue as a step to advance and complement the ongoing peace efforts spearheaded by the Berlin Conference on Libya. What are the possible scenarios in Libya following the dialogue in Morocco?
Yes, it's all about what happens now. Nothing has been achieved by these preliminary discussions. Will there be the political will by the different Libyan factions as well as the internationals to invite the real power players to have a compromise? And that means militia leaders in the West, as well as important LNA commanders from the East, as well as their foreign backers like the UAE on the one hand and Turkey on the other, to accept compromise candidates for the heads of the semi-sovereign institutions. That would be the next step forward. If that's not done and they just try to ram home, hey, you know, we've decided we're appointing this guy, it won't work. And the backlash on the ground will be massive, and then the rounds of civil war will reignite. So there needs to be a connection between the political discussions and the on-the-ground military and political situation, and we've yet to see that. So that hopefully will come, and it's happy to see that the UN Secretary General is involved, but it's really now on Stephanie Williams, the acting UN Special Envoy, to weave together the Libyan and international players for some kind of follow-up conference.
That was Jason Pack of the Middle East Institute and founder of Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. The International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC, is struggling to provide aid to thousands of people fleeing conflict in northern Mozambique. Extremists allied to the Islamic State group are fighting government troops, with civilians frequently caught in the crossfire. As a result, thousands of inhabitants of Cabo Delgado province are escaping for the sanctuary of the coastal town of Pemba. From Johannesburg, Darren Taylor has more in the finale of his two-part series.
The ICRC has worked for years to improve services in Mozambique's neglected northern reaches. It's built water systems and hospitals, but many of these have now been destroyed by the very forces who say they're fighting in the interests of the people of Cabo Delgado.
An overwhelming majority of the population there no longer have access to health care.
Mamadou Sow heads the ICRC's operations in southern Africa. He explains that after Cyclone Kenneth devastated parts of Cabo Delgado about a year ago, his organization rebuilt key infrastructure, such as a maternity ward in the town of Macomia.
Unfortunately, soon after it was rebuilt again and handed over, and soon as people have started to return there and mothers were giving birth there and children have started to be treated there, it was again burned to the ground. This time not because of some freaks of nature, but because of the war going on in that part of the world.
Sal says if he could stand in front of the warring parties, he'd only have one cry for their ears.
For the sake of our shared humanity, it's important for everybody who's fighting in northern Mozambique to know that hospitals, healthcare facilities must be spared. They should not be attacked. They should not be militarized.
In other parts of the world, Islamic State extremists have often shown no respect for aid workers. In fact, they've abducted and murdered some of them. Sao says his field workers are well aware of the dangers involved in operating in Mozambique, but their priority remains the well-being of the inhabitants of Cabo Delgado.
Listen, we are committed. We are committed to being next to the civilian population, to be by their sides, assisting them to rebuild their shattered lives, to trying to see how hope can be restored in such a complicated environment.
But while much of northern Mozambique is no-go for the time being, Saul says in other parts, it's all hands on deck for the ICRC's emergency response teams.
We will continue to help the health facilities, the water infrastructures that have been either destroyed or overburdened by the influxes of displaced people. We will continue to work in prisons to make sure that those who are arrested and detained are treated humanely and their conditions are in line with international standards.
Saul wants to remind both government soldiers and Islamic State militants to give humanitarian workers the space they need to help people. This, he says, as well as a deep respect for human dignity, is after all integral to Islamic culture. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Rights groups say in Nigeria's isolated northern villages, nightfall is fraught with terror as bandits terrorize residents. Osai Ojigo, Amnesty International's Nigeria director, is calling for action to end what she says is a cycle of impunity, perpetuating more violence in a region where no one is held to account for crimes against villagers. She spoke to VOA's Salem Salomon and begins by describing what the villagers tell Amnesty's researchers on the ground about what they are experiencing.
Most of them, their farmlands were raided, so it meant that people came into their land and then uprooted their produce. Cattle was stolen. And in order to instill fear, certain fires were set, either on the farmlands or in the homes. So quite a number of villages have been razed down. And so that means even when they left, people didn't have homes to go back to. Where they resisted or they were able to organize their own groups, mostly young people who formed some sort of militia groups in order to push back the attacks, they came out with sticks and farming appliances like cutlasses and bows and arrows. But then they found that these guys had guns, and they had sophisticated guns like AK-47 as well, which is really quite shocking. So they couldn't match the kind of weapons they had with their own little effort in order to push back the attacks. What was really disturbing is when people's homes were raided, and then the men are targeted, and then they are shot at, and then they use machetes and cutlasses in order to inflict very serious wounds. And there have been cases of children, even as young as babies, being shot at and killed in the attacks that ensued. So it's really is quite shocking, the violence that they've experienced. Even when they are not armed, the armed mercenaries seem to want to inflict as much pain and brutality as much as possible. And some of the communities are quite shocked by this experience because they weren't expecting it to escalate to this level. And that's why they have this sense of abandonment, like our government has forgotten about us. Is it because we're in the villages, we're in the backyard, they can't see us? Maybe we need to move to the city so they can see and hear our pain. And they're even calling to their representatives that sit in the National Houses of Assembly, you need to do something about what is happening to us back in the villages. Sadly, we don't know of anybody, any person who has been held to account for this violence, even if it's by catching those who have killed people. And that is the big question mark in the entire process. Who are these bandits? People have said, are they spirits? Do they disappear in the night? They must be traceable. Why is it so difficult for the authorities to find them? And I think that they need to do a lot more for people to see. So it's not enough for the government to say we're trying our best, we're equipping our soldiers and our police officers. They need to effect arrests and investigate these crimes. Amnesty International believes that this is one of the reasons why the violence has probably escalated to this point, because it's impunity. If people are not brought to justice, then they know they can get away with it, so they'll keep perpetuating it. So this needs to change, and they need to act on it strongly.
Polls opened in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region today in defiance of the federal government. The ballot is a direct challenge to Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who postponed the general elections earlier this year because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The Tigray's Independence Party, which came into existence after Ahmed's 2018 election, is pushing to break away from Ethiopia, as Simon Marks reports from Addis Ababa.
The regional vote has rattled the government of Prime Minister Abiy as he attempts to transition the country into a new era of greater openness. The Tigray region, which led a multi-party government coalition for 27 years prior to Abiy coming to power, staunchly opposed the government's decision in March to postpone the national election because of the coronavirus. It has also called any attempt to prevent its regional vote from going ahead a declaration of war. But critics of the Tigray region's push for elections say the country's former elite are simply using the vote to further their own interests in national politics and vent frustration they are no longer in power. Asnaka Kefale, an associate professor at the University of Addis Ababa, spoke to VOA via a messaging app.
The TPLF, some sections of Tigray nationalists are talking about de facto independence or independence. I don't think so. That would not be the case. Rather, they are creating such narratives to strengthen whatever claims they have in national politics. I don't think Tigray is going to secede from the rest of Ethiopia.
Asnaka also described the point of view that Ethiopia may fall apart as a caricature, and said that people have forgotten that the very people organizing the vote in Tigray were the same people who led a deeply repressive regime that carried out human rights abuses on its own people.
It's a Marxist-Leninist organization. It didn't allow any free competition in the last 27 years. They are very much mad and angry because they were pushed aside.
The Tigray Independence Party, which was formed in June, says full secession from Ethiopia is its ultimate goal. Party leader Guillaume Behe told VOA that he fully expects his party to gain its first seats in the regional parliament. He also said he thinks the election will draw a response from the federal government, likely by pressuring people not to invest in Tigray or by fueling tensions between the Amhara and Tigray regions. Guillaume added that in the aftermath of the election, the federal government may fail to recognize the legitimacy of the Tigray regional government, a situation, he said, that could fuel calls for full independence.
In this situation, the government of Tigray may start to act as a kind of de facto state. Then, depending on what things come around after that, there is a possibility for Tigray to declare independence even unilaterally. We will be pushing for this agenda.
On the eve of the Tigray election, Prime Minister Abiy dubbed the poll a merry-go-round and said the failure of the region to participate in the upcoming national election would render the regional government totally illegitimate. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Leaders of the Economic Community of West African States have acknowledged it's impossible to launch a new regional currency by the end of the year. Nigeria, the richest country in the region, is still defiant of the concept. Nicolas Pinot has more.
The looming end of the year meant a very short deadline to create a new central bank, specify an exchange regime, and deal with a variety of administrative and IT procedures related to a change of currency and the manufacture of coins and bills. Politically, ECOWAS members are still divided on the issue. Nigerian Muhammadu Buhari criticized his francophone peers who unilaterally adopted the proposed eco-currency, calling it premature. However, Buhari said Nigeria remains committed to a single currency plan. Presidential spokesman Malam Garba Shehu said Buhari encouraged the West African Economic and Monetary Union to return to the roadmap for the common currency. He added foreign interference and so-called advice may not be in our best sub-regional interest. It was a clear reference to France, the former colonial power, which has been centralizing the deposits of the Central Bank of West African States, drawing criticism from countries seeking to flex their independence. The French government has pledged to withdraw its presence from all West African governing bodies with whom it had been involved. Still, France remains a key player in the region, providing troops and other support in fighting attacks by Islamic extremists that threaten to destabilize several countries. And the echo will remain pegged to the euro and backed by the French Treasury.
A South African delegation is back in Zimbabwe to meet with leaders of the ruling ZANU-PF party as international concerns grow about the country's human rights record and perilous economic conditions. But underscoring the sensitivities involved, there is still no meeting with opposition officials, activists, and others who are complaining about repression and abuses that will have to wait at least until a third visit. Reporter Kuzai Zenawashi has more from Harare.
An earlier South African delegation last month met only with the Zimbabwe president, Emmerson Mnangagwa. This time, the delegates, all members of the South Africa's ruling African National Congress, or ANC, will meet with leaders of the ZANU-PF. ANC Secretary General Ace Magashule leads the South African delegates. He made a few comments when they arrived Tuesday evening.
We are here in Zimbabwe. We're going to meet ZANU-PF as the ANC. And we'll engage and we'll take it from there. There are many others who want to meet us. We're still going to decide ourselves. Obviously, we'll meet whoever we have to meet. But our meeting is for ZANU-PF now.
On Wednesday, the ANC delegation met with the ZANU-PF but did not meet with Mnangagwa. Speaking at ZANU-PF headquarters, Magashule indicated there wouldn't be meetings with other stakeholders on this trip.
Requests to meet other stakeholders like Transform Zimbabwe, opposition party, and then Dr. Simba Makoni, Zimbabwe African People's Union, ZAPU, Zimbabwe Human Rights NGO Forum, and Movement for Democratic Change Alliance, as well as United States Ambassador to Zimbabwe. But we felt that together with ZANU-PF that indeed, there is no problem meeting with the structures, and therefore we are going to make arrangements to once more come back and meet with these organizations.
Political analyst Vivid Gwede says the party-level engagement will have its limits.
The coming in of the envoys from South Africa is a good development, which many Zimbabweans have been expecting. What is worrying, however, is the discourse, which is trying to say that their coming is for party-to-party discussion, which will definitely limit what they can do in assisting Zimbabweans.
Zimbabwe government says the opposition is creating a false image that there is a crisis in the country. However, human rights activists have drawn international attention to a series of arrests of opposition leaders and journalists, the suppression of protest rallies, and plans to further regulate speech as pointing to a new crisis. In addition, the country's economy has been in a long, steep decline over the past 2 years. Inflation is running at more than 700% a year, and there are shortages of basic foods and medicines. The government has blamed some of those problems on international sanctions, the opposition, and natural disasters. But many economists have said much of the problem has to do with government policy. The South African delegation is expected to fly back to South Africa on Thursday. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hey, Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.